It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. It seems like just yesterday we were talking about all the things we were going to look forward to in the month of August, and now August is gone. But one of the things we mentioned in our sort of preview of the month was that at the end of the month and in the first part of September, all those little ants that make those little volcanic-style anthills in your driveway and around your yard and whatnot, that little ant belongs to a genus called Lasius. And those little guys are about to unleash upon the world all of the winged females and males that will be breeding and creating the next generation of these ants. And you can examine those little cone-shaped volcano-like structures in your driveway or your yard and look at the hole. Now, the ant that goes in and out of that hole is like less than a 16th of an inch long. Well, it's about an eighth of an inch long, and it's about, a 32nd of an inch wide. It's not a big ant. This is something rather small, half the size of a grain of rice. Tiny. Well, in the next couple of days and in the next week or so, they're going to enlarge the hole on their anthill to about the size of a stick match head or a little bigger, probably a quarter of an inch around. And that's way more of an opening than those ants would ever need to get in and out by themselves. But this time of year, the females and the males, these winged ants, are going to come crawling out of there. And they're going to fly off, and the males will breed with the females. And after that, after the breeding takes place, the females will break off their wings, and they will use the muscles that they've developed for flight to create energy that they will then use to excavate their hole and begin their life as a new ant. Now, it's impossible to say how many of them will be successful, but a lot of the literature says that about 1 in 500 of these ants will actually be successful. But that's okay, because there's lots of them. And the males, oh boy, once they're done, if they are lucky enough to get to breed with one of those females, well, then they will go to their death smiling. But those who are unlucky enough to not be able to make that contribution of genetic material, they'll simply end up in the belly of a flicker or some other bird. They're just going to be bird food, because no ants, none of those colonies of ants will allow those males back into the colony. And so those guys are just going to be food for a lot of birds. And speaking of birds, there are a lot of flickers in the area right now, and flickers are one of the woodpeckers that really does a lot of feeding on the ground. There are others who come to the ground from time to time, but the flickers depend on ants as a major source of food for their diet. And the flickers are commonplace right now. Everywhere I go, I see flickers. Now, these birds, kind of grayish looking from the back, when they fly, there's that big white patch of feathers right at the base of the tail on the top of the tail. And the other thing about flickers when they fly, if you're close enough, and oftentimes you can get very close to them before they fly, look at the tail feathers or even the wing feathers, and you will see that they are quite brightly yellow. And one of the other names for flickers over the years has been the yellow-shafted flicker. Now, commonly in this area and in most books, they're called northern flickers. But they used to be called yellow-shafted flickers, and you can see that if you look carefully as these birds fly. The other name for them, another name for them from years past, was the yellowhammer. And most of the yellow occurs on the shafts of the feathers and not so much in the feathers. But if you get a chance, study these birds a little bit with binoculars. Look at that. They have this big black bib, and around that bib there's a kind of a beautiful little lavender color in there, and they've got a little patch of red on the back of their heads. And they're really astounding birds and very, very beautiful. So if you get a chance, take a pair of binoculars and take a good look at the flickers. They're common right now, and they're easy to see, and they are well worth the time that it would take to get out and study them a little bit. And while you're doing that, think about all the ants that are going down the gullet. I was driving out my driveway the other day, and it was after one of those rain showers that we had. And it must have rained pretty good. I didn't keep track, but I had some pretty good-sized puddles in my driveway. And right at the end of my driveway, I flushed a solitary sandpiper. Now, this is smaller than a killdeer, smaller than a robin, sort of bluebird-sized bird with longer wings than a bluebird, but sort of on that size, and longer legs. And when it flies, you see these little white feathers sort of along the tail. And otherwise, the bird is kind of gray-brown on the back and white underneath. But what it was doing in my driveway, I have no idea. Usually, I spot these guys along streams and rivers. Oftentimes, if you go to the North Shore and you're walking some of those streams along there, you'll see these guys flitting from rock to rock up ahead of you. Solitary sandpipers. Not very common in my driveway, but certainly this one was, I suppose, looking for some kinds of little invertebrates that might have come out as a result of the puddles that were there. Got a chance to look at some red-tailed hawks this past week. One flew right down the road in front of me, soaring, gliding, flapping, just minding its own business. I slowed down to match my speed with it, and it was gorgeous to look at. They are astoundingly beautiful birds, big red tails, and amazing to look at. And they are a big bird. They're the size of a raven, so check those out if you get a chance. And speaking of red, as Sam Guida mentioned in his report, the red oaks are dropping their acorns right now. And boy, underneath any oak tree, you're going to see lots and lots of acorns. It's been a bountiful year for acorns and a good year for berries. And all of this conspires to make bear hunting very difficult. I think bear hunting either starts tomorrow, 1st of September. And these hunters usually put out some kind of concoction that they hope will bring bears to their stand so that they can get a shot. But this year it's going to be pretty difficult because there are lots of food out there, lots of natural foods out there for the bears. So good luck to you guys who are out doing a little hunting. The nighthawk migration, I can't say that it's over, but last week was certainly a good week for looking at nighthawks. There were lots of them around, and I hope you got a chance to see some before they slipped out of the area. Some of the flowers that I've been looking at in the past week, one called rattlesnake root or white lettuce. It's a kind of an interesting little plant. The flowers are sort of bell-shaped. The petals are white, but the bract at the top of the flower and the petals as they just come out of the bract are kind of purplish. The stems are usually purple on rattlesnake root, and the leaves are very distinctive. They're quite cut, and they look a lot like a maple leaf in a lot of ways. They look like maple leaves. The plants grow about 2 to 3 feet tall, and they have just begun to bloom this past week. Another plant that's blooming in profusion out there is one called, well, it has several names. I've seen it called goblet aster. I've seen it called calico aster. The actual name is aster lateriflorius. And the lateriflorius refers to side flowering asters. And this is one that's fairly easy to identify because it is one that the leaf and the stem, where the leaf comes off of the stem, it's called an axil. And right out of that axil will grow this stalk that will have flowers on it. So if you look at the stem of the aster plant and everywhere you see a leaf near the top, you'll see a stem coming out from that spot, from the axil of the leaf. And that side flowering aster has that characteristic. You'll see smaller leaves, kind of miniature leaves on that side branch, and then lots of flowers. And the ones I was looking at yesterday in my yard were just covered with blue flowers. Now, they can be blue to purple to white, but that structure, that stem of smaller leaves and flowers coming out of the axle between the stem and the leaf of the plant is very characteristic. So check out the goblet aster, side flowering aster, calico aster, whatever you want to call it. It's out there, and it is one of those asters that is really in bloom right now. Some of the trees that have begun to turn include basswoods, sugar maples, red maples, black ash. In fact, yesterday I noted that some of the black ash leaves were beginning to fall already. For the basswoods and for the sugar maples, we're a few days early, maybe 4, 5, 6 days early on those as far as first flecking, that is the first color. Red maples, we're probably, about average. I think I had 25th, I remarked that there was the first flecking. Now, I think the average date goes back to the 16th of August. But there's always some maples, especially in the red maples, that start early. Yesterday, I saw a red maple that was completely yellow, already changed. But it's just, the one of the first ones. Typically, the red maples hit their peak of color around the 21st of September, but it can easily run into the 1st of October if the weather is mild. So about 3 to 4 weeks before we really start seeing lots of color among the red maples. The winterberry or northern holly, Ilex verticillata, the berries are starting to take a little bit of a blush. This is, if you're looking for northern holly, river corridors, lake edges, any place there's a bit of a water and a little bit of opening. What happens is the berries ripen in October, and the plant actually has a chemical in there that makes them very distasteful. And at some point in October, the plant will pull that chemical out of the berry, and the berries will then become more palatable to the birds. Robins and white-throated sparrows seem to be among the birds that really like those northern holly berries. They eat the berries, and as they fly along these corridors, these openings, they're going to stop and pass some of these seeds right through them. And those seeds will, in some cases, take root, and you will see northern holly coming up in new places. I have a trail that goes out to the lake by my house, and until a few years ago, I saw no northern holly along that trail. Now there are several shrubs along that trail that are coming up, and it's all because out by the lake there are northern hollies growing, and the birds have eaten the berries and then followed this trail along the edge and back toward my house, and in the process have planted some more of these northern hollies. So watch for those. Insects, monarch butterflies are migrating. Lots of them out there. Keep an eye out for them. Darners, blue and green darners are migrating and are just really plentiful. And look for some of the smaller meadowhawk dragonflies. There's an autumn meadowhawk, a white-faced meadowhawk. A lot of the males of this species are bright red, and the females tend to be kind of bright orange. So very worth your while to get out and look for some dragonflies in the next few days. I ran across some of the coral mushrooms this past week, and I wanted to put a note in because, gosh, it's really been a super year for mushrooms. There have been all kinds of mushrooms out there, just hundreds of them of every species imaginable. It was a really bountiful year for mushrooms. Also, final notes, these come from Ed Dallas. He says down in Deerwood, there are still orioles visiting his feeder, and still ruby-throated hummingbirds around, and it'll be about the 15th to the 18th of September before we see the end of the ruby-throated hummingbirds. The orioles are probably on their way out of the area now. Ed mentioned that he had not seen any male ruby-throated hummingbirds at his feeder for a while, so keep an eye out for that. The males have that bright red patch on their throat. And maybe if you're not seeing males, or if you are seeing males, why don't you send us a note and let us know what's happening, because we want to kind of keep track of that, too. We'd like to know when the males leave, and after that, it's usually the females and the immatures that kind of drag the last of that crowd out of the area. And that should happen about the middle to latter part of September, although my latest date comes from our engineer here, Dan Haug, who reported, I think in 2008, he had a hummingbird at his house until October 5th. And that is our latest hummingbird in northern Minnesota. That's the Phenology Show for today. As always, if you have comments, questions, or observations you'd like to share, please send them along. It's time for TalkBack. TalkBack is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got an observation you want to share, a comment you'd like to make, or a question you'd like to ask. It really doesn't matter. We're anxious to hear from you, and you can get in touch with us by calling our TalkBack number. That is 999-9876. You can also reach us at emails by sending them to comments@kaxe.org, or you can reach me personally by sending a message to J. Latimer, that's J-L-A-T-I-M-E-R, at kaxe.org. And of course, you can always write us. We love to get your letters. Our address is 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 55744. We're hoping to hear from you. And we did hear from our good friend Sam, who lives down in the Nisswa Crosby area. Sam is an excellent phenologist and a birder in his own right, and he got interested when he took a class with Jeff Sipper. And we'll be hearing more from a lot of students in the coming weeks as school comes back into session. But Sam sent along this note. He said, "We are back from our Yellowstone trip. We stayed two nights at the Black Hills Custer State Park on the way out and two nights in the Badlands Theodore Roosevelt National Park on the way back. I've been to a couple of those parks, and they're wonderful places to visit. When I got home, I noticed the deer flies are all gone. I won't miss them." Hear, hear, Sam. I won't miss them either, although I still find one or two, but they are certainly a lot less insistent than they were a couple of weeks ago. Also, the days are noticeably shorter on both ends. The Virginia creeper is turning red, and the maples that start turning early every year are turning. The bluebirds are gathering. There are lots of monarchs around this weekend. Is this a recent big hatch, or are they gathering and migrating? I think it's the latter there, Sam. They are recently hatched, but they are also gathering and beginning to migrate. So keep your eyes out. You know, one year there was a migration that sort of settled into the trees over at my neighbor's house, and he called me up, and I ran over there, and there were hundreds of them on every branch of every tree in his yard. It was probably something, a small snapshot of what happens in Mexico where they spend the winter, but here they were gathered there and resting and flipping around and doing a little flying. But boy, it was really spectacular, and that was just about this same time of year. I saw a woolly bear caterpillar on a gopher mound while raking hay yesterday. We are haying late due to rain earlier this summer and then being on vacation. Meadow rue has seeds. The corn is all harvested in the freezer. The pumpkins look great this year. The apples are falling off the trees. Could it be squirrels? I don't know. Certain apples I know are ripe. I know along my mail route, my good friend Chuck out there has a number of apple trees in his yard, and I think it's the Cortlands that he harvested here this past week, but they were ripe and ready to come off, so it was good to see. We were afraid that the hummingbirds and orioles would leave us during our vacation since we were not home to fill the feeders, but now that we are home, they are also back on our feeders. The bees that plagued the feeders before we left are gone, thankfully. Nights are nice for sleeping. There are tons of blue darner dragonflies in the hayfields and along the roads. The flickers are here. The brown-headed bush clover is going to seed soon. Geese are moving around in small flocks. Some acorns are falling. I don't notice them until I step on them in the yard without my shoes. They hurt. And yes, you're right, they do hurt. I was out in my yard under the red oak the other day, and yeah, it causes a fella to dance a little bit. It's state fair season, and I'm leaving today for a couple of days at the state fair, Sam. Thanks for that nice note, Sam, and we'll be looking forward to hearing more from you as the fall progresses. We also heard this week from Tom, who called from the Jacobson area.
Hey, John, this is Tom Shire from Jacobson. Say, we talked yesterday. I didn't get a chance to talk to you about the all the snakes on the road. I know you usually warn the people to slow down, so I think it's that time again, bud. Hey, have a good day. Hope to see you in the woods. Bye.
Tom, thanks for that note, and I have been watching as well, and the gravel roads especially. Those snakes come out this time of year, and as the temperatures cool, they'll be coming out to warm up, perhaps for a final meal, and then they will be disappearing into their hibernacula throughout the winter. Interestingly, this is probably the last meal that they'll eat. They don't want to go into hibernation with a belly full of food because it'll probably rot. Their metabolism slows down to a point where they don't really digest things well. So they'll be out here at the end of August, first part of September, eating, and then they will probably stop eating, though they will still be out on the roads warming up and becoming a little bit more active. And finally, they will find those places where conditions are just right, and they will hibernate. So keep an eye out for snakes if you're out driving around, especially on those gravel roads in the back country. If you see something that you think might be a stick laying on the road, why not straddle it just on the off chance that it might be one of those snakes? We heard from Courtney, who sent along this note, and it's kind of interesting. She says, if anyone out there likes birds and is thinking of planting some trees in the near future, may I suggest a tamarack? I'd say approximately every other morning when I let the dogs out just before dawn, our tamarack has about 10 migrants in it at once. Usually the flock is mostly Nashville, orange-crowned, Tennessee, and black and white warblers, plus lots of immature or female redstarts. Sometimes something else is there, like a red-eyed vireo or a Wilson's warbler. I've been looking at our oaks, maples, and other trees, and it seems they have a definite preference for the tamarack. I don't know why tiny invertebrates are living in it, but the birds are always foraging very actively. Historic land survey tree data compiled by the DNR show that upland tamaracks are not nearly as prevalent on the landscape as they once were. I know bogs are covered in tamarack, but there could be something about upland tamaracks that attracts migrants. Perhaps they like tamaracks surrounded by diverse trees, which provide different foraging opportunities. Anyway, just a thought I'd share. Speaking of feeding migrants, monarch butterfly migration is in full swing. Last weekend on our way to Iowa to see family, Wes and I counted 161 monarchs flying south across Highway 10 between Detroit Lakes and Moorhead. I felt kind of bad for them, thinking it would be hard to find nectar sources in this sea of crop monocultures they were passing through. Even in our area, milkweed and other nectar sources have been displaced by invasive plants like tansy. And it goes on to leave a couple of notes there about monarch migrations and how we might help them. I noticed myself that the monarchs yesterday seemed to be feeding at Joe Pieweed, which is also a good nectar source for butterflies. Other observations, green heron was wading in our lawn grass the other day. It caught a frog or toad. Earlier, a pileated woodpecker was feeding and calling on the ground in the same spot, and a flicker, too. Flying squirrels are quite active after dark lately, as evidenced by their calls, and I found a dead one in Hale Lake this morning. I guess the poor thing might have miscalculated. Thought he was going to land in a tree and ended up in the drink. Oh, well. There are more. And our final call for the week comes from Mark, who called from Crosby.
Why are there few mosquitoes out this year? Not too many down here in this area, and I'm just wondering why. It seems like an ideal summer for the critters. Thank you very much. Bye.
Mark, thanks for the call. You know, that's a question that's been echoing around in my head the last few weeks. In fact, yesterday I had that same conversation at work with a number of people that I work with, and one of the guys from up in Cherry said that, well, there are plenty of mosquitoes up his way, but my experience here in the Grand Rapids area has been that there are nearly none. I mean, it's just hard to get bitten these days. There aren't any, and I really haven't got a good reason for it. There's plenty of water now, although I had this conversation with Bill Berg the other day, too. A lot of the little vernal ponds and those little lowland spots in the woods that normally would be full of water are still dry, and perhaps that's got something to do with it. I really don't have a good answer, Mark, but I'm not looking for him either.
Say, we had a call from Charlie in Grand Rapids. He wants to know if you know where the worms in wild rice come from.
I suspect they must be the you know, most worms outside of the angleworms. Most worms are really caterpillars of moths or butterflies, and I suspect that these must be a moth of one sort or another that lays its eggs on the heads as they're developing, and then the little caterpillars hatch out and munch away at the wild rice, whether they eat the seeds, the rice itself, or the foliage, I don't know. But I do know they're plentiful. Yeah. In some years they can be, you can be sitting in the bottom of the canoe in a sort of a writhing mass. That's Talkback for today. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, Community Radio for Northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Big Fork, Ball Club, and Ball Bluff, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, 105.3 in Bemidji, and audio streaming on the internet at KAXE.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer, and coming up, a talk on the wild side with John and Harry Hutchins, and botanist Chell Anderson talks about some of the blooming wildflowers of late summer. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Bonner Eye Clinic, Doctors Bonner, Mariano, and Kincannon have served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range for over 45 years. Located at 1542 Golf Course Road, the Bonner Eye Clinic is proud to support KEXE, authentic local radio. We also have support from Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tire has offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers online at atchisontire.com. The 8th Annual Goods from the Woods Up North Marketplace and Living Green Celebration is going to be Saturday, September 18th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the IRA Civic Center in Grand Rapids. Goods from the Woods is Northern Minnesota's premier artisan market with a large selection of unique handcrafted items made from the bounty of Minnesota's forests. Online at goodsfromthewoods.org or call KAXE for more information. 218-326-1234. Time now for a talk on the wild side with John Latimer and Harry Hutchins. Harry's a forest ecologist, and he teaches in the forestry program at Itasca Community College.
Last week on Thursday, I had my ecology class out in Feely Township, which is just about a mile and a half this side or that side of Warba, the great burg of Warba, which is one of the listening communities, the KAXE, right? I think the sign says now there's 183 people in Warba. You go up the hill a little bit on 74, and you start getting into some interesting hardwood communities. And I was teaching the students the plants, and of course these days we teach plants without flowers because the herbaceous plants rarely have flowers. So there was all sorts of good things starting to bloom, the zigzag goldenrod, some of the late ones that you find in a hardwood forest.
Yep, I haven't seen one yet this year, and they're blooming.
And the Indian pipes have well into brown, as you've mentioned.
Yep.
And the interesting thing, we were walking back, and one of the sections of the class said, "Harry, come here." And they heard, of course, my hearing isn't the best, and they heard this scuttering around and inside the about a 6-inch diameter maple with a frost crack. So it wasn't a big tree. And sure enough, there was a whole family of white-footed mice, a little paramiscus running around in there. And they're with those big eyes looking out. You know, they're arboreal. So they're tree. They hang out in logs and trees anyways, and they climb. They're nocturnal, and that's why they got those big eyes, because they need to get the little bit of light they can get at night. And so they're active at night, but this group, we awoken them, and then they were climbing up and down. And this crack in this tree was maybe about an inch wide, just enough for them to probably crawl into and for us to watch them.
You think they've got big eyes. Imagine from their perspective.
Oh, look, man.
Looking out that crack and all those eyes pressed 20, against it.
20 students and me.
Look at the size of the eyes on those.
Oh, man.
And now the white-footed mouse, those are one of the vectors for Lyme disease.
I know.
And just about everything else.
Yeah.
They're out there sacrificing themselves to the ticks.
That's what I told the students too. They're of course a big part of the food web, and as they're the base, and there's lots of them. And this is probably their second brood, and they were just the youngsters in there were just probably ready to go. And any hawk in the future that's migrating and moving by that little ridge is gonna be looking for listening to something like that, as well as what you talked about earlier. I heard you today in your show talking about snakes.
Yeah,
and of course a snake could crawl up in there and
you betcha
and do some damage. So
God bless them.
You bet. I'm still trying to trap them out of my basement. They seem to be doing a real good job. That is the mice.
Yeah, right. I know the feeling. Holy mackerel. And it's only going to get worse. This time of year, they really start looking for places to spend the winter. And your house and my house and Scott's house and all you people listening, your houses too. Yeah. They're going to be looking for a way in. And once they find that avenue, they're going to come tromping in. And you're going to have to run a trap line.
Or get a cat,
mm-hmm. Sure. Although I had a cat once. I made the mistake of getting a male, and he wasn't much of a mouser. He would play with them a little bit, but I remember one instance where He caught a mouse, and he was playing with it, and he swatted at it with his paw, and he flipped it, and it went right over the back of the couch, and then he just stood there in the living room looking around like, well, what happened? Meanwhile, the mouse, who's now in another room, is like, oh, man, I better get out of here. So, yeah, mice and cats, yeah, that's not a bad combination. You can do some damage that way.
And one of our cats picked one up yesterday. And one of the things to keep in mind, of course, with this, there's a pretty good bur oak acorn crop, and that's only going to help the mice. So they'll,
mice?
Yeah.
They'll, I would have thought that bears and squirrels would have been way ahead of the mice on the oaks.
It probably doesn't take many acorns to make a mouse happy. So
I suppose.
I mean, that's a good food resource for them, too. So the other thing I wanted to talk to people about before I headed to class is that we also found a red-back salamander.
Wow.
Out there at in that Feely area in those hardwoods. And it was in an area that had been logged, but they had left a number of down material, and that's a good thing. And we found about a 3-inch long red-back salamander.
Nice one.
Yeah, and that's long for them. They're an amphibian, but they're in the genus Plethodon. And in the Plethodons, that whole genus, there's several other species in the United States. But that genus doesn't go to the ponds like we think salamanders and other amphibians, frogs,
so
and
like
stuff
the blue-spotted salamanders and the tiger salamanders and those guys all go to the water to have their to lay their eggs.
Right.
But the redback doesn't.
No. These guys get fertilized. The male and female get together, and then the female lays an egg under the log. And I'm not quite sure, John, if they're a group of eggs or one egg with a lot of little growing embryos in it or exactly what it is. But they stay in, it grows up in this egg with a lot of water in it in a log, which the logs stay moist through the driest times.
Right.
And then hatches there. And then these guys are predators, too.
Excellent.
So they eat a lot of insects. And then a lot of things eat the red-back salamander.
All right.
So still some salamanders out there. And remember to put those logs back
exactly
after you're done.
Harry Hutchins and John Latimer with a talk on the wild side on Phenology Plus. Harry is a forest ecologist and instructor at Itasca Community College. Chella Anderson is a botanist, and she lives in Cook County and works for the DNR. She spoke recently with Jay Anderson from WTIP Radio in Grand Marais about what's flowering in late summer along the North Shore.
We'll start with some pinks and purples in the flower department. One of the real obvious ones along roadsides or in sunny openings in the woods, sometimes as large patches, sometimes just as individuals or smaller groups, is fireweed. Tall plant with bright, deep pink to purple, sometimes a plume of flowers at the top of the plant, very showy, and this is a native plant that is important to the recovery of burned areas or any kind of natural openings that get created. Another plant with purplish, sometimes pale to darker purple, and abundant small flowers is the Joe Pye weed, which is part of our wetlands, open sunny wetlands or stream, lake shores. Very common but very showy, very beautiful, I think, plant. The flowers are born in kind of a flat to slightly rounded topped big head at the top of tall plants that have very lush, kind of sometimes even a little bit purplish green leaves. So it's quite a handsome plant, very robust, and you know, looks really vigorous right now. In the mix also right now are two other groups of plants that are kind of challenging for most people if they're trying to really learn, and the groups of plants that are really setting off the countryside right now in terms of color are the goldenrods and the asters. And we'll start with the goldenrods, which you know, the name pretty much says it for most of them anyway, that they are gold or yellow, very bright, really almost a glowing kind of gold. And although they can be, as I said, difficult to learn to recognize individually, there are a few easier ones that are common in the county. And I'll start with a couple of shorter species, so they wouldn't be up to your knee. They'd be less than the height of your knee, and growing in open, generally drier places, including Lake Superior Shore. And one of those is the stiff or hairy goldenrod. And the hairy comes from the fact that the stem is very, very dense with coarse hairs. The other one, called Gray's goldenrod, also has hairs, but they're very fine, kind of downy hairs, and give the stem kind of a gray appearance, but also short, nice little group of smaller yellow flowers at the upper half or so of the stem. Then we get into some taller ones, and in the wetlands right now, so old beaver meadows or fens along the shores of lakes and ponds, would be the swamp goldenrod. That's the one that's blooming out there right now. So if you're out in one of those kind of places or along the edge of one and you see a goldenrod out there, that would be the swamp goldenrod, beautiful in bloom right now, and gets quite tall, can be even up to waist high on a person. The last one I'll mention of the goldenrods is the Canada goldenrod. The bloom on that is like a plume, shaped like a plume, so wider at the bottom and kind of tapering to a graceful tip, narrowed tip at the top of the plant. Gets quite tall, can be even, I've seen some up to shoulder high on myself. So these get very tall. On to the crowd of blue and white flowers that are really common right now, and that's the group I was going to talk about, which is the asters. Another sometimes difficult to identify for folks, but we have a couple of white asters that are in bloom right now, and one is has a number of common names, calico aster or side blooming aster. And this aster has small white flowers, so no more than about a half an inch in diameter. They grow, or they emerge from the side branches, all along the side branches of the plant. So it's a tall plant with lots of branches and has all these small aster-like white flowers. The other white one is the flat-topped aster, and that aster is, again, tall, maybe up to waist high, and has, instead of flowers out along the branches, it pretty much has one cluster of flowers at the top that has a flat top. In the blue aster, easier to identify right now would be the large-leaf aster, which, if you've spent any time in the woods anywhere in Cook County, you have seen this, whether you knew what it was or not. And it is most recognizable by its large basal leaf, which can grow over large areas where it's shaded, and it creates these big heart-shaped leaves, basal leaves, and when it gets into a patch of sun, then it will flower and put up a fairly tall stem of slightly heart-shaped leaves along the stem, and then a cluster of blue flowers at the top.
Are these the asters with it, where the leaves are slightly sweet-smelling and sticky?
Yeah, they can be. In fact, if you walk through them during the course of the day, or you have a pet, dog, whatever, that runs through them, and you come back inside and you change your clothes and, you know, sniff your pant legs or check the dog, snuggle with your dog, you're going to smell this. I think it's a wonderful smell of the large-leaf aster.
Shell Anderson, DNR botanist and plant ecologist, thanks for helping us understand what's going on around us this summer.
You're very welcome.
Our thanks to Jay Anderson and community radio station WTIP in Grand Marais for contributing to Phenology Plus. And Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Dale's Auto Body in Grand Rapids. For over 25 years, Dale's Auto Body has offered a facility where repairs are done by professionals to factory specifications. Dale's also offers Permatex spray-on bed liner, the next generation of spray-on liners. Dale's Auto Body strives to meet and exceed customer expectations. We also have support from the Itasca Surgical Clinic of Grand Rapids. At the Itasca Surgical Clinic, patients are provided with personal screening, diagnosis, and treatment of a full range of medical conditions, all in a caring environment. Deep Portage Learning Center is located on 6,100 acres of forest land in Cass County between Hackensack and Longville. The center offers a variety of outdoor activities and classes for all ages. Deep Portage also has over 18 miles of hiking and ski trails, an interpretive center, and educational programs open to the public year-round. Online at deep-portage.org. And the Forest Stewardship Program helps private landowners in northern Minnesota plan a timber harvest, improve habitat, and address insect and disease problems. A professional forester will meet with you and help create a forest management plan based on your goals. Foresters may be able to identify programs that can help with some of the costs of carrying out your plan. For more information, call KAXE 218-326-1234. Itasca Water Legacy Project is a group of people from different organizations got together from some private and public organizations like the DNR and the county, Itasca County, as well as concerned citizens about the water quality in our lakes. Itasca County has over 1,000 lakes and some of the best water quality of our natural waters in the whole state of Minnesota and indeed in the upper Midwest. And the Itasca Water Legacy Project has created programs to monitor and protect those water resources. And one of them, one of those projects has to do with water testing of area lakes. And as part of the project, the Itasca Water Legacy Project has created a lab at Itasca Community College, a certified water testing lab, so that people on lakes can collect water samples and find out what their water quality is. And in most cases, it's very good. Joining us is Ken Zimmer. Ken is from the Wabana Chain of Lakes Lake Association, and he is the chair of their environmental committee, and he's going to tell us about some of the testing that's gone on the Wabana Chain of Lakes. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Scott.
Yeah. Well, first of all, tell us how this testing works. What do they do?
Well, our testing on the Wabana Chain started several years ago, 1991. So we have been testing longer than most lakes in the area. In our case, we take four samples at four different dates, like we take one in May, July, August, September. And we do that at nine different points on the chain. Now, your listeners may or may not be familiar with our chain of lakes. We have four larger lakes and one small lake on the chain. So those samples are then tested for phosphorus, they're tested for chlorophyll A and nitrogen in our case. Now you referred to the Itasca Water Legacy Project. Their tests are going to be more extensive than that.
Well, now you have four different lakes there. Is the character or composition of the lake, you know, the natural biology of those lakes, are they very different, or some weedy, some very clear? How would you describe them?
I'd describe them all as quite clear. We get Secchi discs readings, maximum readings up around 25 feet, and then now we're down to around 17 feet when there's more bloom and more plant material in the water. But blue water, little trout, big trout, and Wabana all have about the same disc readings. Now, they are different somewhat. There's some different depths. Of course, Wabana is by far the biggest with about 2,200 acres, and trout's the next largest with about 1,800 acres. But they have some different fish species in them, so that's a factor, like the lake trout that are in blue water and trout that need certain conditions that they have to have to survive.
Well, let's talk more about some of these things you're measuring. First of all, the Secchi dish is just a disc that you drop down in the water to measure clarity. I've heard of that, but talk about some of the chemistry that you're looking for and why you're looking for certain levels of different things.
Well, the phosphorus, of course, promotes plant growth. So the more phosphorus you have, if you go above the recommended levels by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, you're likely to get a lot more plant growth, a lot more algae. The chlorophyll A is an indication of how much algae you've got in the water. So if your chlorophyll A is high, again, you've got a lot of algae in the water, and in general, you don't want that. And of course, lake shores, septic systems, lake shore management, that's what's going to probably add phosphorus to the water, and that's what you want to be aware of, is what you do on your lake shores and what your septic systems are doing, and if you have agriculture land around where that's feeding into your lake system.
So you mentioned that you've been doing some testing on Wabana for almost 19 years now. What have you learned, I guess, over the last 19 years? Have you noticed?
Our lake system has been fairly stable. We don't test every year. We tested in 91, 99, 205, 208. We're going to test again this year in 210. So the intervals between have gotten closer. But over that period of time, sometimes you'll get a spike in a certain area of a lake, like in the Wabana. Wakeman Bay tends to be a little shallower, and get a spike in the chlorophyll A reading, but then that may go down. And there's a lot of variation there with weather. If you get a lot of rain, of course, that washes a lot of things into the lake. On a summer season, when you get very little rain, you'll probably not have as much of a spike in the phosphorus going into the lake. So you get variations, but our chain has been pretty lucky in that our Secchi disc readings and our readings on those other two parameters have been consistent for all that period of time.
That's terrific, yeah. How do people in the Wabana chain feel about this testing? I know some of the testing I've heard on other lakes, not on your chain, though, has led to the discovery of, for example, failing septic systems, which can be very expensive to fix. And is there a lot of concern around the lakes about what you might find in the way of bad news?
Well, there is. And, of course, there's a concern. There's a problem with the expense of the testing. Our lake association has about 120 family members. It costs around $3,000 or more each time you do these tests per season. So there's a cost involved, and so raising that money becomes a concern or an issue with our lake association. But in general, the members are very concerned. Our mission statement for the association is dedicated to the care and preservation of our lakes for the enjoyment and safety of all. So probably caring for our water and our lakes, that's our number one priority.
Okay. So now, what's the relationship with this lab at Itasca Community College like now? How does it work?
That was started by Itasca Water Legacy Project. As a Wabana Chain of Lakes Association, we weren't directly involved in that. We are one of the members. We have contributed financially to the Itasca Water Legacy Project. And then there's the Itasca Coalition of Lake Associations, which there are about something like 13 lake associations in Itasca County. So they're all the way from Turtle Lake up north and Deer Lake and Pokegama and so on. So all those have contributed financially to this Itasca Water Legacy Project, and we're just one of them. We used to have to send our samples off to a lab at some distance. I think it was in Brainerd, or I'm not sure where it was, Brainerd or Twin Cities, which was more expensive. And it's great to have this lab right here at ICC. We can educate students. We can do the testing right here. The students there can come out and take the samples. So that's been a great addition to our water testing.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard our lakes in the last 20, 30 years have experienced a lot of more intensive development. Have you seen that on the Wabana chain of lakes as well?
We have had some development, yes. We have, on this chain of lakes, we have quite a bit of public land. Trout Lake, the most northern lake, which goes up into Balsam Township, is almost entirely surrounded by Chippewa National Forest. Wabana and Blue Water both have Chippewa National Forest on them. So those public lands reduce the possibility of development. But still, there's been development. The one thing we've done that's been real positive, ahead of maybe most lake areas, lake associations, is our septic systems. We, early on, several years ago, we agreed to comply with current standards and bring our septic systems up to standard. And we've gotten that done. And every landowner around the lake had to have their septic system tested, and then brought up to standard if it didn't meet the standard. So that was a big plus for our lake association.
And was it difficult getting people to sign on to that testing?
It was somewhat difficult, although in general, most people saw the value to the water and lake, and they wanted to do it. And of course, there's quite a bit of expense involved there sometimes, several thousand dollars sometimes if you had to upgrade your system. But that was a big plus for us.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see as the long-term benefit from this ongoing testing? I guess right now there's a lot of maybe some baseline information about the quality of the water.
Well, that's what you need. You need a benchmark so you know where you are. If you don't know where it is, then in the future you don't know whether you've gotten better or worse. So that's the important thing. That's why we feel fortunate we started that long ago. And that's why all the lakes in Itasca County, this Itasca Water Legacy Project will just be great to establish benchmarks for many lakes that have none. And then you can tell what happens. Invasive species are another issue, which is really big for us and for everybody. And so we want to monitor our lakes for that, too. That's an important issue in addition to the chemistry of the water.
Any sign of those invasive species yet?
No, not in our channel lakes, not so much. We feel probably boats coming in and out of the water are probably the number one vector for bringing invasive species in. Oh, it could come from aircraft. So we try to do things and inform our. We welcome the public to come. Of course, there are public accesses on our lakes. We love for them to come and fish and use the water. But educating them about what to do to keep the invasive species out is important.
Yeah, big job. A lot of traffic now in and out of our lakes. We didn't used to have so many public accesses. And as you said, it's a great thing because more people can use the lakes. You don't have to live on a lake to enjoy them as much anymore. And that's a good thing. Well, Ken, thank you for telling us about the Itasca Water Legacy Project and then testing at the Wabana Chain of Lakes. Anything else you want to add about your program or what your goals are?
Well, our association is open to any member that wants to join, because most of the members do live on the water, but members that live in the township or even persons that just use our resorts and love to come up here, they're glad to have them as members. Our membership's only $20 a year, and we send out a newsletter five times a year. We have a lot of history information there. It's interesting. That's something we didn't talk about, but we have a history committee that's great on researching what's happened in this area for the last 100 years or more, and they publish that information in our newsletter. So a lot of good things if someone would like to join our association. We have a website. If anybody wants to look at that, it's www.wcola.org, and they can see some of the things we're doing.
Ken Zimmer, he's the chairs the Environmental Committee for the Wabana Chain of Lakes. And thanks a lot, Ken, for talking with us about the Chain of Lakes Water Testing Project.
Thank you for calling, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want more information about the Itasca Water Legacy Project, testing on your lake, or the possibilities of getting programs like that started, just give us a call here at KEXE, 218-326-1234. We were talking with Ken Zimmer there about some of those invasive species that can do great harm to our lakes and streams. So boaters and anglers, again, are reminded to be extra careful to prevent the spread of those invading aquatic plants and critters that do that harm to the lakes and streams. When you take your boat out of the water, clean off all the plant material on the boat and trailer, empty water from live wells and bait containers, and dispose of unwanted live bait, including worms and minnows, in the trash, not in the water or woods. And campers are reminded there's a state law that prohibits bringing firewood into state parks and forests. Transportation of firewood has been directly linked to the spread of the emerald ash borer. That tiny insect has already killed millions of ash trees in the upper Midwest and is moving towards northern Minnesota. Campers should purchase firewood from local vendors in and around state, federal, and county forests and parks. For more information, you can go to the DNR's website at the state of Minnesota. You can Google that or just give us a call, 218-326-1234. That's Phenology Plus for this Tuesday evening. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Thank you for listening.